I want to ask you about the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. A lot of people are talking about that this year because it's 2013 and it's been 40 years since the Supreme Court legalized abortion. And there are people who say that there's a generational split in the reproductive rights movement and that millennials such as yourself either don't care as much about the issue as older women do or you're not as fiercely pro-choice. But there's been a lot of conversation about that sort of generational divide. But the work that you do, when I was just doing the introduction to you, would seem to refute that notion. So what is your view? What's your take on millennials and reproductive health and justice?
You know, Sally, this conversation is so interesting to me. And I think some of where it stems from is the very true reality that millennial women have not known a world without legal abortion in the United States. And so there's this concept that since we didn't suffer in the same way and we were fortunate never to have to go to back alleys with any sort of regularity, that we aren't as protective of those rights. But really, I think that because of our blessedness, that it's really the opposite. We have always known a world where it's legal for a woman to make choices about her pregnancy and her preparedness to parent, and we don't want to go back. Some of the conversation that I've heard stems from a survey that said that millennial women don't know what Roe v. Wade is. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was sort of amusing because when you think about the state of American education
and, yeah, it's true.
In our history classes, I mean, how many people know individual court cases? That's just not what many of us are focused on. But although the language may be different and perhaps we're not fiercely protective of Roe v. Wade, we know that it's so important for women to have bodily autonomy and to be able to decide what's right for her, what's right for her family, and we consistently show up when there are battles around choice. We showed up for Planned Parenthood when it was going to be defunded, and the fact that the organization is able to continue in the way that it is and not only provide abortion care but provide other reproductive health services, including contraception and so many important screenings, is largely because of the activism of millennial women. We showed up online, we marched, we donated, Planned Parenthood funding went up because of us and because we care. And so I think that that notion is an interesting one. And, of course, we always need to be talking about intergenerational things, and that's going to continue as long as there are progressive movements. But the concept that because in whatever survey they did of particular millennial women, they couldn't identify a court case, I think that's a bit off base.
That's actually a very good point. In talking about millennials just now, you talk about activism, advocacy, online organizing, social media, all the rest. What are some of the unique gifts and value that millennials bring to this debate that add value to the battle for reproductive rights?
That's a great question. I think we bring a lot to this debate. In addition to the fact that we're so comfortable with technology and the way that that can connect us in ways that I think were unfathomable even 10 years ago, I can go and talk to, a feminist in Egypt online if I want to right now. I could log on and do that. And so that connects us in ways that make it much easier to mobilize very quickly. Thinking globally, we're in the U.S. the most diverse generation that America has seen yet, and that's only going to continue when people are coming behind us. And so that diversity, racially, ethnically, in our sexuality, we're very diverse, and we're very progressive because of that, because we grew up in schools and in communities where we were always in touch with people that were not like ourselves. And so many of us know the importance of inclusivity, that I think when we talk about reproductive justice, we are really talking about more than abortion. And that may actually get to your earlier question about why some of us may not identify as pro-choice. I think millennials, we don't like labels that limit us. Mm-hmm. We really tend to reject anything that kind of boxes us in. And so when we talk about reproductive justice, we're talking about it in its broadest and truest sense, the right of every woman and every family to really control what it is that their family looks like, if they're going to parent, when they're going to parent, how their children may impact their lives. And we really, I think, have gone so far beyond the choice model to include things like gay marriage. I mean, if we look, states are getting more and more progressive on that issue. We're more and more comfortable with people choosing the gender that they want to live with. We believe in trans rights. We believe in so much more than just the right of an individual woman to terminate a pregnancy. And I think that that's incredibly valuable for the movement. And it's so important to acknowledge that just because maybe one millennial woman doesn't call herself pro-choice, it could be that she's so far beyond that.
I'm so intrigued by your idea of just clicking on your computer right now and chatting with a feminist in Egypt, which couldn't, I mean, that just is like, let's just do that right now. That you couldn't have done that a long time ago, and that has huge implications. So can you just talk for a minute about your the world is a very diverse place. You're saying that your generation is more diverse than others. By connecting women around the world and having informal conversations, having alliances, having more familiarity, what does that do to the work at home? Does it make it stronger? Is there a stronger global connection? Just what are the consequences of that?
I think that it has huge implications for how we do our work. For instance, say I am interested in, maybe HIV education. I'm not just thinking of it from my office here in D.C. I can think about it across the country. What are other states doing? Are they moving towards a more comprehensive sexual health curriculum? What are they doing at the world?
It seems to me that maybe we're less likely to stereotype other women's culture, other cultures of saying, oh, this culture is backwards, or the women are oppressed in this culture because they don't look like us, and maybe less likely to impose a Western or American model of feminism if you actually get to know or even read blogs of women in other countries. It breaks down stereotypes, and you read individual accounts that, as with anything, any issue, you get to see nuance, you get to see what's authentic, you get to read about real communities, and you get to see that one size doesn't fit all.
Absolutely. I would very much agree with that.
Yeah, I think it's, so that just feels like a win, you know, that feels like a real win. And in as much as different groups can be connected more globally, that feels great. I want to ask about your job right now at the Black Women's Health Imperative, and you operate at the local level, you act, and at the national level as well. What are some of your top projects this year, and what are some of the challenges that you're facing?
Well, we are actually celebrating our 30th anniversary.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. We'll be celebrating in October, and I am not at liberty to release the details on that, but it's going to be really exciting.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, and the Black Women's Health Imperative was founded in the concept of reproductive justice. That is our grounding, just the idea that Black women need to be able to control their bodies and to control their own wellness and their own lifestyle, whether that's talking about sexual health and reproductive rights, or whether it's something that may seem to be across the spectrum, something like chronic diseases. And so what we're really doing this year is getting back to that grounding in reproductive justice, and we're kind of going back to basics in the sense that Black women need to be able to have control over their own health and bodies and wellness and families. We're specifically focusing on sexual health and reproductive justice as one priority issue area, and then the other issue area that we're focusing on is lifestyle change. And they really are working in tandem because, as we know, in order to make choices about our families and our reproduction and our sexuality, we need to be in the most well and whole state of mind to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds exciting. So, and you're
it's
doing that
exciting.
Both locally and nationally as well. And so we'll be on the lookout for news this coming October. Happy birthday, Black Women's Health Imperative.
Right? Yes, thank Very you, exciting. Sally. I'll pass that on.
Very exciting. I want to talk to you about the Leadership Institute that you've been a part of all year, all last year. So, as you know, CAP has this Faith in Reproductive Justice Leadership Institute, and you've been one of the key leaders and participants in that. Can you tell us about that connection? So we've been talking about reproductive justice so far. Faith is another key component of that in your life and in your work. Lots of times people don't see the link between the two. They see them opposed. What's the link for you?
For me, the link is inextricable. The story that I love to tell when questions like this come up is that my first sexual education was actually in a Sunday school classroom, which I know anyone
That's a surprise.
Listening,
yeah, right.
Yeah, anyone listening is like, what in the world?
Where did she go to church?
Well, my mom was
It was your mom, minister. Exactly.
Yes, it was my mom. She was a youth minister in the AME church, and looking back, they were actually being very forward-thinking and progressive. It was in the late 90s when some Black churches decided that they needed to really address the HIV/AIDS epidemic that was and still is really doing damage in our community. And so they decided to do a program called Keeping It Real, What's the 411 mm-hmm. on HIV and AIDS. And, you know, at the time, that was, like, very hip language.
Right.
To put that out there.
Late 90s hip language.
Yes. Right, exactly. It was really on point.
Yep. And
so in that class, I was taught that sexuality is a beautiful thing. And it is divinely sanctioned. It's not this shameful, secretive thing. And I think that it's so unfortunate that many people don't believe that their faith and their reality as a sexual being can coexist. But my faith embraces the right of everyone to have pleasure and to also have bodily control over themselves and to create relationships and family structures that are best for each of us. And so then when it comes to reproductive justice, I mean, if sex is a good thing, then the product of that is also potentially a good thing. And so whether a woman decides that product should be a child or whether it is intimacy and a relationship, that's a decision that's best left up to she and her God. We really can't intrude on that divine relationship. And so, to me, I can't imagine a faith that's honest and true and doesn't acknowledge that God created us to be sexual and to relate to one another in that intimate way. And, yeah, that's a good thing. And so how can we then shame women for, after having sex, needing to make their own decisions?
Mm-hmm. That sounds excellent. Absolutely right. I mean, you're talking about something that's divine, that's sacred, and intruding on that with politics or something
Absolutely.
Else from some outsider, that feels kind of profane, actually, because what
to
do
me,
they know?
It absolutely does, Sally. I mean, I think to enforce, whether it's government or society, to enforce something on a woman in the midst of this beautiful, intimate thing is just, I can't imagine it. I can't imagine any sort of faith that's punitive mm-hmm. in that way. It just doesn't ring true to me.
And, you know, there's been a lot of talk about religious liberty lately, especially with the contraceptive coverage mandate in the new health care law and some groups not wanting, some religious groups not wanting to provide that mandate or that coverage, claiming religious liberty. But just the way you're talking about it now, it seems that for somebody to make those decisions for you, to take away your right to determine your pregnancy, to determine your family planning, your use of contraception, is a really core violation of your religious liberty because of the beliefs that you just expressed. Those are your religious beliefs, and somebody would be trampling on them if they took away those rights from you.
I completely agree, Sally. I mean, if we are going to be a true democracy and believe in the separation of church and state, then no one else's church gets to right. have more importance than mine, right. or really than someone who has a completely different set of values than mine. I think that faith is such an individual thing, and that's a beautiful thing about our country. We should not ever change that. Particularly when it comes to such a private, personal matter as my own family planning.
Right, right. And somebody's free to criticize you and say they think you're wrong, or they're even free to say they think you're a sinner. But what they're not free to do is take that theological belief and make it a law so that you have
Absolutely.
To follow it, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, it's important that we bring these conversations into the public square. I think that's one of the most wonderful things about the Leadership Institute, that it gives us all an opportunity to sort of air some things out and talk about mm-hmm. them, and it's great to learn. It's not great to then take those beliefs, as you said, and trample upon anyone else. I mean, I think America is this great social experiment. We're still in the midst of it, and we have to learn to get along with one another, and, you know, we really can't should on each other.
That's true. I have another leadership institute question for you. Around the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, you and your fellow leaders released a public statement, which was a joint public statement on what you believe about faith and reproductive justice. And in the statement, you call for faith communities to be advocates on this issue. Now, just in the work you do, both personally and professionally, there are probably a range of things that faith communities can do, that faith leaders can do, just in terms of their own congregations and in terms of the public square. Do you have any ideas about what some of those things could be?
I do, and I think that the Leadership Institute has been transformative for me in that it's really given me the concept of kind of bringing my whole self both to my faith work and to the work that I do in reproductive justice. I think one of the most important things that any person of faith can do that is progressive and does agree with me, you know, it's good if they agree,
sure.
Is to come out about that. And I know that coming out language, you know, is usually talked about in terms of sexuality, but we can't be closeted people of faith if we're going to do this work with integrity. It's important for the people that you work with at maybe your clinic, if you're a part of an escort program, it's important that they know that you're doing this work out of a place of faith. And by the same token, those faith leaders who are clergy members, I think it's important that they bring their progressivism and their belief in reproductive justice into their pulpit. I think that those are opportunities that we miss, and we've allowed some sort of regressive faith leaders to really take the reins and define mm-hmm. in this country what it is that people of faith think about women's health and about our sexuality. And I think that we need to change that conversation often and starting right now. I also think, as you mentioned in my bio, I've done work in my church's women's ministry, and I know in the churches that I've belonged to, women's ministries can be really thriving places of community. And I would love to see more women's ministries really address issues of sexuality and reproductive health and provide a space for women to talk about their experiences. I mean, statistically, 1 in 3 women has terminated a pregnancy. And so that means that in our congregations and in our pews or in our mosques, there are women who have terminated pregnancies. And we should make our places of faith places where women feel safe, where they can bring their stories and get support and validation for the decisions that they're making. Because I would imagine that if all they're hearing when it comes to religion and their bodies is that things are shameful and, you know, it's dangerous and pregnancy can be this punishment for acting outside of someone's belief about what she should have been doing with her body, I can imagine that that would be very hurtful for a woman. Mm-hmm. So I would love to see women's ministries become a place of healing, if that's needed, or celebration about the choices that we're making.
Those are great ideas. So it's within the church, healing and celebration, and clergy coming out with reproductive justice and rights beliefs, and then folks who are, as you say, escorts to clinics and other work out in the world to come out in terms of their faith to help push down that stereotype of everybody who's religious is opposed to reproductive rights and justice. I've got one final question for you. This has been, for me, a really inspiring conversation because you're doing so much good work. And yet we know out there in the world, there's a lot of barriers and obstacles to the work that you do. I mean, there are across states, across this country, there are more and more laws being erected, making it harder for women to exercise their God-given rights in terms of parenting and children. So when you do sort of face these obstacles and the kind of everyday realities and the grind, what gets you up in the morning and gives you the energy to get through your day, and what gives you hope?
The simple answer to that question is relationships. Relationships give me energy. They give me hope. They remind me of the importance of this work. And, of course, coming from a place of faith, you know, the most important relationship with me is with my God. And so that is energizing. And then in addition to that, your question is so timely because last night the Women's Information Network, which, as you said, is a community of pro-choice Democratic women, were about 1,100 strong as of last night. And we just had this amazing event which honored 48 young women who are pro-choice and Democratic here in the D.C. area who are doing incredible work. Of course, that age means that they're millennials, mm-hmm. so we're really coming full circle. And it was so exciting to hear about the work that they're doing. Women are organizing. They're organizing politically. They're organizing in their communities around labor issues and violence against women. And they're just doing these incredible things. And to see them gives me an inspiration. It makes me want to keep going. And not only keep going, but run faster. I'm just so inspired by my peers right now. And today, I'm just like, I'm vibrating with excitement about what the world can be if women are given the opportunities, or more accurately, as you know, Sally, if women take the opportunities to continue to move forward and stand on the side of one another and on the side of our brilliance. So I'm energized by the women around me and in some cases, men.
Well, you know, that's a perfect note to end on because March is Women's Month, and I believe it's next Friday, a week from today, March 8th, is International Women's Day. So
absolutely,
it's a celebration of women around the world and locally in our communities, neighborhoods, and families. And you just gave a great sort of shout out to the women that you work with, and it's very inspiring to hear. So thank you so much for your work and for the work that you and your buddies are doing. It's really, really crucial.
Thank you so much, Sally, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about it.